Hello, dear friends. Greg Kokel here. The show is Stand to Reason. I'm your host, and we'll be with you here for next couple of months at least. And probably beyond that, I have another writing retreat scheduled in September, late August, early September for Wisconsin. But in those kind of circumstances, when I'm not on vacation, I just broadcast from there. So we'll probably be with you for months and months and months. But and a lot of interviews coming up. A lot of our main players for our upcoming launch of this season's reality conferences starting the last weekend in September in Orange County. That would be September 24th and 25th for SoCal, and when Calvary Chapel is all great guns for that. We're looking to accommodate 3,000, and we got shut out last year. We're going to try to make up for lost time. And many of you, that was our flagship operation there for what first started out as Rethink, and now we call Reality Apologetics Conference. And that we're really thrilled about Calvary Chapel as a host. It was the very first church whose threshold I crossed as a brand new Christian in early October 1973. I had just become a believer 2 weeks prior on a Friday night on September 28th, and that early October Friday night was a concert of some group that was, you know, the birth of the contemporary Christian music movement. All out of Calvary Chapel in Jesus movement days. And I went to the concert and brought some friend, my brother and my former girlfriend, who put her trust in the Lord that night. It was just great. And she continues now 48 years later as a strong Christian. And we stay in touch. That's great. But that's where our event is at. And actually, we've had more people for reality/rethink over the last few years there, then we're in that auditorium tonight as a brand new believer. I walked into that church for the concert, and thrilled for what they did then, thrilled for what God is doing through us now. That's the 24th and 25th in SoCal, in Seattle, October 15th and 16th, in Minneapolis, November 12th and 13th, in Dallas, February 25th and 26th, and in Augusta, Georgia, April 22nd and 23rd. So you can go to realityapologetics.com to get all the skinny on our events there. Incidentally, I see a note here that Stand to Reason is now on LinkedIn. Those of you who are involved in that kind of business networking enterprise know how that works. I don't, but I'm just letting you know. You can just search for Stand to Reason and click click. It says click follow to see updates on latest apologetics content. I guess they mean just search for Stand to Reason and click. There you go. And you'll get updates. All right. I just got this summary sheet here. By the way, don't forget, if you cannot call into a show when you have a question, waiting on the line sometimes is hard. If you cannot call into a show, you can always STR tweet it. Okay. Oh, make that STR ask it. I mean, make that hashtag STR ask it. Okay, you put a tweet-type question anywhere and include in the message hashtag STRASK, and Amy Hall and I will answer that on one of our STR Ask podcasts. And that there's a new show every Monday and Thursday. By the way, just got the latest numbers for STRU. I am so thrilled that we have 3,088 students now at STRU. We have two new courses. John Noyce, who's here with me outside of the studio, taking your calls in Amy Hall's absence. She's on vacation in Northern California. John has a course on Are the Gospels Reliable History? All right. And also, why apologetics? In other words, it's an apologetic for apologetics that Tim Barnett is hosting and teaching. Those are online right now. You can go to training.str.org to get the courses, sign up as a student, and I think what is that, about 6 or 7 courses we have so far, and we'll be adding more, all right? I'm putting up a next round. We try to do every 3 months, we do a new round every quarter. In the next round, I'm doing one on atheism. I call it Bumping Into Reality. Maybe that'll be the title. Looking forward to that. I know John wanted to do it. You know, I pulled rank on him on that one. John the atheist, the former atheist. But he was just going to do my talk anyway, or some variation of it. I thought, well, I can do my talk. So I'll be doing that, and that's all coming up. So STRU, Stand to Reason University, simple, accessible courses that you can take that will solidify you in your convictions about Christianity. Oh, no, I talked too much. We lost a caller. Do you have the question that caller had asked? Okay, well, you hang on to it. You can give it to me at the break, and I'll see if I can answer it. Yeah, sometimes folks just die in the vine because Mr. Kokel is too loquacious in his lip. So my apologies there. Listen, I don't want to lose Ash, so I'm going to take Ash right now, and then I'll come back after the break to my commentary. Ash, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, thanks for having me. First, before I get to my question, I just want to say I'm going to CIA in August, so I look forward to seeing you there.
Oh, good. Super.
Yeah. So my question was actually about publishing.
Okay.
So I just finished writing, editing, and illustrating a manuscript, and so I'm looking at getting to that publishing phase. I've been listening to what you and Jerry Warner Wallace have been saying about writing books recently over the past few months, and I saw that self-publishing really isn't the way to go because that's me promoting my own content, so I really want to look for a publisher. So my major question is, how do you get to publish that first book? Like, how do you get a publisher who wants to release your book?
Sure. Let me ask a question just for clarification. Did you say that you listen to Jay Warner and me, and you think that self-publishing is the way to go, or to find a standard publishing house?
Sorry, I think that self-publishing is not the way to go.
Oh, yeah, okay. For some people, it's the only way to go, but the problem is that your distribution is going to be extremely limited unless you're very, very, very clever. And if you're very, very, very clever, then you're clever enough to convince a publisher that you're clever enough to promote your book, okay? So what this means then, when you say how do you get published, you're not talking about the writing side, you're talking about the publishing side, right?
Right.
Okay. You have to think like a publisher. And what a publisher is looking to do is two things in the Christian publishing business. I'm just thinking most charitably. The first thing they're looking to do is to make an impact for the cause of Christ. The second thing they're looking to do is to make a profit. So they want to have an impact to make a profit. If they can't make a profit, they are going to pass on the impact potential, because they have to stay in business, okay? So what they're going to ask of any writer is the first question that was asked of me back in 1983, where I started to put together a manuscript. This is long before Stand to Reason. And I was putting together a manuscript on relationships. And, I mean, I'm not going to go into detail because it was an embarrassing book. But I went to a writer's conference, and I talked to a publisher about it. We had a conference for an hour. You know, you can do that at Christian writer conferences. You can meet with someone and discuss your book idea and give them a chapter and see what they say. And the first question this publisher asked me was, why should anybody read your book? And I didn't have an answer, you know. So you had a broken relationship. So what? That was what that prompted the writing of this book, or at least the attempt. And I ended up trashing the whole thing, to be honest with you. It just was junk. It was garbage. It was me emoting on paper, and it just wasn't very good. Maybe there's some redeemable ideas, but there wasn't a book in it. And there was no reason anyone would buy that book from me. Okay, now, if I was Kim Kardashian, well, then somebody would read it because it's Kim Kardashian. In other words, she already has a market and a footprint in place. And this is what a publisher cares about. They care about selling your book. That's what you care about, too. You don't want to write a book that doesn't sell. The reason is because writing a book is really hard. I mean, unless you're just doing it for fun, which I can't imagine that, because it's not fun to write a book. It's fun to have written. When you're done, then the fun begins. you know? The fun is more fun when the work is done. That's the way that works. So so you want to make a difference for the kingdom, and if you can make a little money on the side, fine. It's hard to get rich in the Christian publishing business, I'm telling you. I've done pretty well, and it's not happening, right? So what a publisher is looking for is a marketing footprint. And the way that you approach a publisher is with a book proposal. And a book proposal contains a number of different things. Now, you can go online and probably get boilerplate outlines of the kind of thing that a book proposal has got to look like. But one section nowadays, what they're going to ask you is how many, it's a marketing section. So they want to know what's the title of your book, what's the concept of your book, what is the competition of your book concept already in the field? How many other people have written books like you've written? Okay, because they're looking at the competition. And if there is no competition, in other words, you're doing something singular, and it turned out that's the way tactics was. There are very few books that were even marginally similar to this. Well, that's good. If you're unique, you have a unique, what Jim Wallace calls a unicorn, you know. You've got your unicorn. You got your unique thing. You're in your lane, so to speak, like Cold Case Christianity. That gives you marketability. But that's just part of the package. Then they're going to want to know how many followers you have on Facebook, how many followers you have on Twitter, how many on whatever social media you're working in. They want to see the numbers. They want to know whether you can do interviews on the radio or TV. They want to know whether you can teach or speak. And there's a lot of people who can write well who can't speak well, and they're not very good doing interviews. If they have a good talk show host, they can make the best of it. But the more that the author, and here's what I'm really getting at, the more that the author is capable of effectively marketing his book, the more likely that a publisher will publish the book. Will you sell the book for them? The author sells the book, not the publisher. Now, I'm not saying the publisher doesn't do anything, but the reality is that it is the author who does most of the ground game. And especially if you're a new author, you don't have any track record, if the publisher picks you up, they're going to have a marketing package. You're going to ask them about that, but it's not going to be very excessive. And it won't matter that much to them because they're not going to give you an advance, not right out of the gate. So they don't have any skin in the game. Now, if you have a successful book, then you can campaign for an advance. And the bigger the advance, the better, because they are then committed to more money to get back by the sales of your book. And so they're going to work harder at promoting the book on their end. But still, the lion's share of book promotion comes from the author in all the different ways the author could do. So, we're talking just about the publishing side, not whether you've got a good idea, a marketable concept, really, or you're a good writer. That's a whole separate issue. It's just, what is a publisher looking for in a business relationship with a client? And that's what they're looking for. Why would anybody buy your book through us?
Yeah, that really helped, because like when I wrote it, I was trying to think of, I'm not just trying to put something together that's already out there. I was trying to think of, what do I wish was out there when I started? Something that's not there yet. So I really like what you said about like the unicorn. What makes it different?
Yeah, but well, that's part of it. I mean, there's a lot of general apologetics books out there. Okay, so if you're a no-name trying to do that, you're not going to get, they're not going to buy you. Now, if you're you know, somebody who's already got a massive footprint and you're going to do a general apologetics book, then you're going to get sold. Who is the guy? Didn't Rush Limbaugh's brother, what's his name? Dave Limbaugh? I've had communications with him. I just couldn't remember his name. David Limbaugh. There you go. David Limbaugh. Now, he wrote a book on apologetics. That's not his lane, so to speak, but he got a publisher because he already had a really big footprint and they knew they were going to make a profit off of him. Okay. So he really liked The Story of Reality, by the way, and gave it a huge write up. So really helped me launch the sale. But by the way, that's another part of your footprint. It's what people that you know that like you that have their own big footprint. In other words, if you don't have a big footprint and you can hitchhike on someone else's big footprint, that's going to mean something to a publisher, if you can count on that, you know, that hitchhiking, so to speak. And in fact, when I just signed got accepted on a new book project with Zondervan, and one of the questions that was asked, or one of the things that I have filled out on my book proposal, was who are the people that I know that are significant players in the marketplace that would endorse my book? Okay. And so I, you know, doing what I do and knowing who I know, I mean, I've got a pretty good list. But that's something that is built up over years and years of experience. And my first book that was published was 1998, and that's Relativism. And I was able to get that thing because Frank Beckwith, who had already published, did the footwork with Baker. But once that book was in play and had some visibility, then that gave me a little bit more credibility when the Tactics book came out with Zondervan, and I was able to get I think a fairly sizable advance in that situation for someone who had not published with Zondervan before and only had one book out with it that they co-authored. But that's how the momentum builds, and then that sold really well. Then I got Story of Reality, and then Tactics 10-year anniversary edition, and you know, it's just kind of build. So if you have others that will endorse your book, that they themselves have a platform, that's going to help too. So you have to think marketing. I mean, that's one. Sad to say, it's not how well you write. You pretty much you got to write well, and you got to have a good concept, but it's not enough if you're a first timer. If you've got a platform, you can be a bad writer and still sell a lot of books. I can tell you some people who've done that, but I'm not going to mention them. Oh, no. John is no way. John said J. Warner Wallace. Those, okay. Okay. I should have said that. I'd be a traitor. He's just joking, though. Yeah. No, Jim does a good job. But there are other people that, just because they have big organizations, they can write junk and even theological junk, and it gets sold because a lot of people follow them and would buy it. So anyway, I'm just kind of, you know, scattering some different issues here, scattergunning ideas for you. Yeah. But so how far along are you in your manuscript?
I'm just working on formatting now. It's all written and edited and illustrated. So I'm just making the final touches.
Oh, it's all written. Distracted. Okay. Do you have an editor?
No, I'm actually editing it myself.
Okay, you need to get an editor. I'm just saying, Ash.
Okay.
But it's got to be somebody who's going to be tough on you.
Okay.
I have two really tough editors on my team here. Okay, Nancy Ulrich and Amy Hall. They're tough. They catch everything. Amy is a word Nazi, a common Nazi. I'm telling you, but they are. It's not just grammatical, though. That's big. Amy's already checking on whether I get my facts right, whether the quotations are right. I mean, this is a big thing in publishing. You can't misquote people. You can't make mistakes like that in a published piece. And Nancy's got a great ear for writing. Good writing is, it has a euphony to it. It has a beautiful sound when you read it, even inside. You're not reading out loud, but it has a nice sound to it. And there's a way to accomplish that. So Nancy helps me with euphony. And Amy's really good with structuring things. And if things are not crystal clear, Amy's going to drag me back over it and pester me until I give in. And usually she's right. Almost always she's right. And so is Nancy. So you got to have people like that in your corner before you send the manuscript to a publisher. But do not send the manuscript to the publisher, without having the publisher request it. You have to send them a book proposal. They don't want a manuscript. They will not read it. You send them a manuscript, they will throw it in the trash because you're breaking the rules. You're presuming on their time. They want to see a book proposal. And so if you go online to any publisher, they will tell you what a book proposal needs to look like. Okay, what needs to be included? They may give you a basic outline. Here's what we need. You got to play ball according to their rules. All right, and you also have to offer a type of book that's appropriate for that publishing house. You know, if some publishing house does do academic work, some do apologetics and theological work, some do kids novels. You know, you just got to make sure you understand the publisher you're approaching with your book proposal. And then if they like the proposal, then they'll ask to see, to maybe see more. But the book proposal usually requires at least one chapter of your work so they can see how you write. It's all part of, it's all pro forma. It's all part of the format that, and all the hoops you have to jump through if you want to get a book published. It's just the way that works. But if you go online, then you'll at any publisher's website, look for writer's guidelines. Writer's guidelines.
Okay. Yeah, okay. That makes sense. Like, know the audience I'm sending it to.
That's right.
That I know what to give. Okay.
Yeah, and make sure that you cross every T and you dot every I, not only on the book proposal, but in on your writing stuff. You don't want any grammatical mistakes, no misspelling, no awkward sentences. This is what your friends have to help you catch, because you won't see that. I went to a book conference once, I mean, a writer's conference once, and there was a little workshop, and the title of the workshop was Murder Your Little Darlings. John is laughing because I've told him that before when I've worked with him as a writer. Murder Your Little Darlings. There are things that writers come up with that they think are really clever, but they draw a lot of attention to themselves as writers, and they look a little hokey, but they love them. And what this writing instructor was telling the students is, kill those things. Murder your little darlings. We don't see them, but a good editor will. So if you have some friends that will help really clean it up, and you send it to a publisher and they like it, they're going to put their wolves on it too. Their editors are going to go for it and even clean it up better. But you want to make sure you send them the cleanest copy you possibly can.
Okay. Yeah, I'll definitely do that. One last question.
Sure.
Is there any specific publisher that you think I should look into?
Well, I don't know what your topic is. Is it apologetics?
Yeah, it's apologetics on does God exist?
Well, what I would do, there's a lot of publishers that would publish something in that genre. Okay, here's the thing to do: look on Amazon for the apologetics category, like the bestsellers in apologetics, all right? And then look at the books in those categories and see who the publishers are. So Zondervan publishes, Baker publishes, Crossway publishes, though each of these houses have a little different profile, especially Crossway, but they accept submissions on apologetics-type books. And then there's a whole bunch of others that Natasha Crane has her publisher. I think that Alisa, she's got, she's with, I think she's with Baker Bookhouse now. So, you know, just check that out, and then you'll find it. Then go to their websites. If you, bigger houses are going to be more demanding. Like Zondervan's a really big house, okay? It's a Harper One house. So it's a big house. It's just hard to get sold in Zondervan. Okay, but the smaller houses, Baker's a smaller house, and some of the others, I think it's going to be easier to get published with. So that's what I suggest you do. Look at apologetics books, look who the publisher are, make a list of those, and then go to their websites and see what the writer's guidelines say. And that would be a good place to start.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, buddy.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're so welcome, and I hope you do well. And if you get a publisher, give me a call. Tell me about it, all right?
Sounds good. Will do.
Okay.
CIA.
All right. Bye-bye now. Well, that was fun. I like talking about writing. I don't like doing writing. I like talking about it. All right, let's go to break, and we'll come back and we'll chat a little bit more. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking. And we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, and our newest apologist, John Noyes, are available, both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues, and science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read their bios and learn more about the topics they cover, visit str.org. Then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, or John today.
Back at you here on the show, Greg Kokol, your host on Stand to Reason. I want to go back for a few moments. What happened to that caller? They disappeared? Oh, okay. Well, I want to go back a few moments. I want to go back for a few moments to a topic I raised in last hour, a conversation that I had with you all regarding the Bethel College LGBT Bible study group. Now, I need to say that I don't know the circumstances under which this precipitated, this Bible study, whether it's an unofficial or official, or whether there's some arm twisting that forced the college to accommodate. So I'm just not going to judge that right now. It does concern me, and a lot of places don't put up much of a fight when I think they should, but I don't know everything that's on the line there. So I'm not bringing that judgment against the school, but I am raising the question about the legitimacy of something like an LGBT Bible study. Because as I mentioned to the young man who told me about the existence of such a study at a Christian college, that was a contradiction in terms. But when you think about it, it's even more, what I'm trying to do is instill in people a sense of how bizarre this is, because so many people have just gotten used to the idea that there are people who identify as Christians who are also LGBT, and therefore this seems to legitimize even having a Bible study. For that kind of group seems to legitimize the group. Yeah, well, we're Christians, and here we're having a Bible study together. Now, my conviction is, and I mentioned it a moment ago, this is a oxymoron, because you can't have a Christian group that is LGBT. Well, the T stands for transgender, I guess, so that's another issue, but the gay, homosexual, let's just say that. And because the Bible teaches that's sin, that behavior is sin. So how can you have a group that really kind of exalts the behavior, which behavior the Bible teaches is sin, and at the same time say we're a Christian Bible study group? That's why I called it an oxymoron. But I think it's worse than that, because I guess the question is, what sense does it make to identify a Bible study group or community, their mini community, by one's sexual affections. Now, think about that. Now, I don't mean to be coarse here, but I'm just going to give another example, masturbation. If there's an LGBT crowd that identifies as Christian because they think that being lesbian or gay is not inconsistent with being Christian, I don't know how they can figure masturbating being inconsistent with being Christian. So that's got to be on the table, right? Okay, so what if we had, and pardon me for putting it this way, this is not a parody. This is taking the roof off a little bit on a tactical basis. What if we had a masturbation Bible study? I mean, it's painful to even say it, and I'm not trying to get laughs. I'm being absolutely serious. But the reason why people are tempted to laugh is because it sounds so ridiculous. But how is that any more ridiculous than a gay Bible study? Because in both cases, it's a Bible study with a group of people who are there gathering based on a fleshly sexual preference, even if I don't moralize about the behavior, even if we don't moralize at all, does it make sense to have like a masturbation Bible? How about this, a fornication Bible study? We got heterosexual fornicators. We're all having an open call to all heterosexual fornicators. We're having a Bible study together. We're going to be the hetero fornicators group. It's just so bizarre. Isn't it bizarre? But why do we think that's bizarre and not a gay Bible study? Because both are groups that are identified by sexual appetites. What? But nobody says that. Nobody says, what? Wait a minute. Wait. That's like square circle or something like that. What are you talking about? Because the way the culture has acculturated us to this broader issue, okay? We've come to accept it as kind of, even though as Christians, we'll say, biblically informed Christians, we'll say, no, that's not sound, that's not right, that's not God's purposes, etc. But it doesn't jar us like masturbators' Bible study is jarring, right? Or fornicator's Bible study is jarring. But in each case, all three cases, you have a Bible study that is geared for people specifically of a particular sexual appetite. What's up with that? That is bizarre. And our it doesn't mean we have to be impolite, but our internal reaction to a gay lesbian Bible study should be the same internal reaction we have to a masturbator's Bible study. I honestly don't see the difference in substance. The only difference is that we've been socialized in favor, in a certain sense, or away from the bizarre notion of a gay Bible study, and we haven't been socialized in that regard with masturbation Bible study or fornicator's Bible study yet. And I say yet because even though I'm asking serious questions here, it does sound a little like parody. The problem with trying to parody these things is you can't do it because before long, the parody becomes reality. I used to talk about gender dysphoria. And again, not meaning to be cruel, but trying to put this in its proper perspective. And I asked, what if a person thought he was a rabbit and wanted to modify his body to conform to his self-identity as a rabbit? What would we do? So that's my parody kind of thing to show how bizarre this is. Then people started sending notes and said there are websites like this about people who think they're animals. There are people who think that they're amputees and they're not, so they're going to doctors to get their arms cut off or limbs cut off to match their self-concept. I am not making this up. So for all I know, these other unusual Bible studies will start popping up on campuses around the country. Who knows? It's just so sad. What am I appealing for? I'm not trying to make fun. I'm not condescending. I'm not being uncharitable. These things are happening. I want people to see reality. I said this many years ago when Bruce Jenner went public with his own affliction. And affliction is what it is, sadly. And I did a video because that we put online because so many Christians were confused. And it's the essence of the video was this. Bruce Jenner is confused. Sadly, he will never be a whole person. But just because Bruce Jenner is confused, and so are a lot of Hollywood types that are just as confused as he is, doesn't mean you have to be confused. This is not difficult. This is not hard. You don't even need a Bible to figure this one out. You just look at the nature of reality, how it's structured, and you will see that sex is binary. That's how we reproduce. Sex and gender are the same. They're synonyms. And it's binary, male, female. By the way, it just struck me. I was thinking about it today. Gay and lesbian. Those words presume binary genders. Lesbian is a female who has sexual attractions to other females in the same, you know, in a sphere for gays. So if sex isn't binary, how can there even be such a thing? Yeah. World is upside down, friends. It is just completely upside down, but you don't need to be upside down. And this is why I wrote the piece back in 2019. I think it was September, October, right? Solid ground. Faithfulness is not theologically complicated. I actually wrote it. I just thought of it. It occurred to me. I put it on a post-it and stuck it in the front of my Bible. It's still there. I'm looking at it right now. Faithfulness is not theologically complicated. Because I'm thinking about all these ways that people are going south. All these ways that many who identify as Christians seem to effortlessly embrace secular ideas that are completely at odds with biblical reality, which is reality. And that progressive Christians, what they support, what they champion, are just the same things that the world champions. Not one way, but many ways. Sexually active as single people, gay-friendly. And here I mean, don't mean that they're appropriately friendly with gays, but rather they're supportive of alternate sexualities, right? They're comfortable with gender fluidity. They're in favor of same-sex marriage. They're pro-choice and on and on and on. In fact, since they reject the authority of the Bible, or at least that it's inerrant in any meaningful sense, and therefore it's not authoritative, they reject the blood atonement. What is it about their religious convictions that qualifies as being Christian, other than that they have paid lip service to Jesus in some very generalized sense? And it just seems to me there are a lot of Christians who have fallen into a trap that Paul warned about when he said, do not be taken captive by philosophy and empty deception according to the traditions of men, humans, rather than according to Christ. That's in Colossians 2:8. Mark it. Don't be taken captive. Don't be trapped by it. We're talking today in our staff meeting, though, and Tim Barnett brought this up. He said, I was reading, because I had made reference to a passage in 2 Timothy. The time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate to themselves teachers according to their own desires. Now, I think the words there are important. And I was zeroing in on tickled and desires. They want something to tickle their ears. They want something that will justify fulfilling their own desires. And so they're going to find teachers that will do that. But Tim picked up on another word. Paul said they will not, what? Endure sound doctrine. Well, endure is like when you're, you know, in a tough spot and you press on through the hardship. Yes, meaning, and I'd never made this observation before, and I'm indebted to Tim for the observation, meaning that sometimes we have to press on through doctrines that are sound but not fun, not pleasant to our fleshly desires. They won't endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will gather to themselves teachers according to their own desires and will follow myths. And you just think of all of this stuff, this, you know, the gender fluidity, the beauty of homosexuality, pro-choice, all of these things are just myths. They are false views of reality. And we can be sympathetic to people who are genuinely stricken with gender dysphoria, who believe themselves to be, for example, a woman in a man's body, or vice versa. It's a tragic, tragic situation. But what they have is a false belief, and they are afflicted by a false belief. What you don't do when somebody is genuinely afflicted with a false belief is try to encourage the false belief that's afflicting them. You try to communicate and persuade them of a true belief to restore harmony and wholeness. Anyway, the piece is called Faithfulness is Not Theologically Complicated, and you can find it at str.org. Let's take a break, and we'll come back for our final segment.
When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group, helping STR-trained Christians to confidently and graciously defend their convictions. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our ongoing work. As our thanks for your partnership, we have created some benefits to express our gratitude, like a 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and more. To become a strategic partner, visit str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate and choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email Ocean Wilson at ocean@str.org.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here, your host for the show. Now, it is a huge, emotionally painful thing for me to have a sweet caller stay online for a long time and then expire just when I'm about to hit their button. And I'm so sad to see them go. In this particular case, Cam from the Bay Area died on the vine. And so, but I still want to answer his question so I know what it is here. How do I share the gospel with someone who doesn't care? How do I share the gospel with someone who doesn't care? It's amazing how frequently I get this question. And there was one time when I thought of something clever to say. I can't remember that. I have a standard answer. And with the exception of the clever thing I thought of that I forgot, that was a mistake. I should have written it down somewhere. Maybe I did, and I just can't find it. But generally speaking, you can't. You can't share the gospel with someone who doesn't care, because they don't care. It doesn't have significance to them. Now, I think, and maybe this was the thought I had, that the only avenue of approach that offers any possibility of promise is asking questions about their apathy. Oh, I don't care about that stuff. Really? I'm curious. Why not? Doesn't have any significance to me. In what sense? And see what they say. So at least you're talking about it and you're getting them to talk about it. And sometimes when you get some momentum in a conversation, you might uncover something that gives has promise for at least allowing you to offer something meaningful to put a stone in their shoe. But I don't know of any other way to do that. In fact, in chapter 2 of the tactics book, I talked about something I learned from the wife of my discipler. And her name was Kathy. And she said to me early on as a Christian that when she is sharing the Lord, she is alert to the other person's responsiveness. And then she cited John chapter 10 and was one of the few people that cited this particular passage in context. That is, it captured the spirit of what Jesus meant. And Jesus said, "My sheep hear my voice." Now, this notion has been terribly twisted by almost everyone that I've ever heard cite the passage, as if Jesus were talking about the discipline or skill or capability of hearing the still small voice of God, and we kind of tune in and get it right, and so then we can understand what God is saying to us. Now, I don't think that that is a sound biblical teaching, but that conviction aside, certainly this passage is not talking about it, but it's the passage that almost everyone cites in defense of the view, "My sheep hear my voice." Well, Jesus was speaking a figure of speech. Really? How do you know that? Because it says in the text. He wasn't talking about hearing any voices or of anything like that. He was talking about something else for which hearing his voice was a figure or metaphor. And Kathy got it right. That is, there's a sense that in some circumstances, the Holy Spirit is working in such a way as to open the eyes or stimulate the interest of an individual in Christ. And the way she put it is, when I share, I just watch to see if there's essentially any interest, which to her was analogous to hearing the voice of Christ, and that the calling, and okay, they lift their head, is the way she put it. Sometimes they lift their head. The sheep lifts their head. The sheep lift. Did I get the plural? The sheep lifts their head. Lift their head. Anyway, they pay attention. You get it. And other times, they just keep on eating grass, right? So if they're eating grass, I just don't mess with them. The way I've put it in the past is, I'm looking for the person who's looking for me. Now, there may be other points of view on this, and I appreciate that. And, you know, I could be wrong, but this is just the best place I've come regarding this issue. I'm looking for the person who's looking for me. If they're not showing interest in what I have to say, I'm not going to beat them over the head with it. I'm going to let them go. Let them eat grass. Now, this doesn't mean that that is a perpetual condition for that person, because I ate a lot of grass when people talk to me about Christ. Actually, a lot of times I just fought back, you know, pushed back, got into arguments with these Christians who were so stupid, I thought, when I was in college. But I wasn't open to the gospel. It wasn't until other things happened in my life, and some of them borderline tragic for me, that I began thinking more spiritual terms, thinking about spiritual issues. And it was right around this time that my brother Mark began, well, he had been attempting before to talk with me, but now I began to engage him more and listen. Pushed back a lot, challenged a lot, but I still was engaged. And when that happens, you stay with him, as he did with me, a couple years. especially the last year, you know, right there with me until I finally became a Christian, 1973 in September 28th. But he was there when I was ready. And as I've often said since then, that particular night, the fruit was ripe and it just dropped into the bucket. He didn't have to try. In fact, I told him I wanted to become a Christian. Okay, ripe fruit is easy to harvest. This is why I emphasize gardening so much, because you get ripe fruit by good gardening, not by attempting to harvest fruit that is not yet ripe. Okay, so when there is tragedy in a person who has a lack of interest in spirituality or in Christ or anything about the spiritual realm, the tragedies oftentimes will open their eyes to their need. And then they start asking questions they didn't ask before. They start listening in a way they never listened before. So if the person that you're looking to share with, and this is for Cam from the Bay Area because he is the one who asked the question, is somebody that's not paying attention now, and there are people in your lives, family members, then somewhere down the line, that could change when something changes for them. It's a seasonal thing. There are five kids in our family, my mom and my dad, all right? All the kids became Christians eventually. And I was one of the last, actually. I was the last of the five kids, now that I think about it. And my dad also became a believer, what, a year and a half before he died. See, my dad was a tough guy. He was a labor union leader from Chicago, okay? He was a union organizer, and he's the kind of guy who could never be wrong. And he had a history of a tough life, and he pulled himself up by his bootstraps. I was just talking with somebody just recently, maybe it was John, who drove us back from the airport at midnight last night. And, you know, we burned out in 1955, Good Friday. I was four years old, not quite five. Our whole farm burned down right to the ground. We barely made it out with our lives. My dad was 25 years old, four kids, and declared bankruptcy and moved back to Chicago. His dream of being a farmer ended, and started doing pickup stuff just to take care of his family, and ended up in this other business. But that's how he was, a tough guy. And he saw our lives as Christians. He made fun of it. And he wasn't having any of it. And we were trying to be faithful to talk with him. And nope. Until towards the end of his life, 70 years old, and he has bypass surgery, and it really scared him. And he turned to the Lord and had a dramatic conversion. He was a different human being after that. He couldn't talk about the Lord without getting all weepy. I mean, my tough dad, right? I'd only seen him cry once, and that was at the graveside of his parents. He was orphaned when he was 10 years old, and we went and visited the grave, and that was the only time I ever saw him kind of get all misty-eyed. But after he became a Christian, man, and he'd get up early in the morning before it'd light out, and then he'd spend time with God, read his Bible. A tough guy, right? So you never know what it's going to cause, what is going to happen, what will be the cause of a person taking a genuine spiritual interest and then the Lord getting a hold of them. By the way, there was nobody there to harvest in a certain sense. That harvest happened because of the gardening that had been done in his life, not just by us, but especially by his older sister, who was the most saintly Christian woman I ever have known, Aunt Bernie, Bernadette, and how she continued to pray for him every single day, and how he looked up to her and would listen to her because she was 17 or so when their parents were killed. So she took on a little different role in his life. But that was the factor that made the difference. So it was the input of someone else, and it was in the midst of this tragic circumstance that it all came together and the fruit got ripe and fell into the basket. And so you could have combative people. You could have people who are have no interest. You have people that are combative. They're pushing back. They're making fun of you. They're laughing at you. They're fighting with you. But the Lord can still get them. People don't even want to talk about it. You do the best you can. You don't push the river. Just let it go. But down the line, in the fullness of time, the circumstances are such that the Holy Spirit takes opportunity to work through hardship and trial. When God gets their attention, let's put it that way. Sometimes it takes a 2x4 for some people. That was my dad. And incidentally, the surgery was successful and he was born again. But in the surgery, they found a spot in his lung. And that metastasized into his brain and it killed him about a year and a half later. So he had a short time with the Lord. He, as I put it, entered the kingdom as a spiritual baby, unfortunately, because he had no time to grow, really. Smelling of smoke, as it were. I don't mean cigarettes. I mean like wood, hay, stubble smoke. But he still got the kingdom in a wonderful way. So you never, ever know. Don't give up on anyone. Let's look at me. I was a tough cookie. And God was pleased to rescue me from the domain of darkness and transfer me to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom there is redemption and forgiveness of sin. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.